Hallo, jy bevind jouself by Tunes Live. Tunes Live is 'n geselsprogram wat ek voer met plaaslike musiekindustrie rolspelers en musikante. Dit spruit voort vanuit Tunes Studio, wat 'n rehearsal en recording studio op Stellenbosch is, wat dienste bied soos rehearsal space, live sound, recordings, die retail van musiekprodukte en bykomstighede, sowel as musieklesse wat by Notes Music School binnekant die Stellenbosch se Paul Bothner Music Tak aangebied word. Vandag chat ons met Justin Versveld, of soos sommige van julle hom ken, Justin Credible. As jy al by aandklas was en al daar gigs gespeel het of geluister het na bands, dan is die kans goed dat jy hom daar gesien het of op stage of agter die mixing board. Hy is 'n ou wat al verskriklike interessante plekke geloop het en verskriklike interessante jobs gedoen het in die musiekindustrie en beide kante van die soundboard sy man gestaan het. Hy het vir die band Third World Spectator gespeel en hy speel ook tans saam met The Jumping Guns, Nick Marucci, Hugo Brandt. Hy was vir 'n tydjie ook saam met Bam Bam Brown en The Wild Professors gewees. Regtig 'n great, great musician hierdie en 'n ou wat baie interessante insigte het om te deel oor om 'n sound guy te wees, om 'n musician te wees en iemand wat die ins en outs van hierdie industrie al gecheck het en het verstaan. Ek dink hy is verseker 'n ou waarmee 'n mens nog 'n klomp interessante goed sal kan gesels, waarby 'n mens nie in 'n geskatte tyd geleef van 'n uur plus, uur 20 minute altyd kan by uitkom nie. Dankie dat julle luister en dankie dat julle aanhou luister en ja, niks verder van my kant af nie, geniet die show.
I've been watching a lot of this guy who builds stuff on YouTube and he goes, yeah, well, I'll take that out later, and then leaves it in. Mistakes, or he's just standing like, and he's just standing like busy painting something or measuring something, busy speaking to himself about something completely unrelated.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I'll take it out later.
The thing is, if you come back to it, it's not actually that bad.
In the moment, you think, oh, yes, that was stupid.
Yeah, and then you like it. Like, a lot of times I've told myself, okay, remember to take that out. And then I listen to it, and then it's actually like, it's fine. Yeah.
Do you edit it yourself?
No, dude. No, Mark does it for me.
Okay.
He does a lot. He like, he uploads the stuff and like, also with a little bit of help from the guy that does my website.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Mark's responsible for getting the stuff online and like all the edits and putting the tunes in and all of that.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So I don't even. I'm gonna ask an honest question. Where were you born, man?
Me, George.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So that's why you always take some trips to George.
Yeah, it's like my go-to place for a bit of time off. Mm. Like after a tour or something, especially the Third World stuff, you'd be like back to back, and you're just like, want to go for a week. It's such a great place
to get the head level again.
Yeah.
And so obviously your parents are still there.
Yeah, my mom's there. My dad lives up in the Karoo, which is even more out of the way.
Where in the Karoo?
A little town called Willamore. Yeah.
Okay, and your mom, what does she do?
She's in social work, but privately with an NGO called Life Community Services. They feed kids.
All right.
And help kids stay in school and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. And she's been doing that for quite a while?
Yeah, quite a while.
Okay.
Yeah, it's at least 15 years old.
And your dad?
He's an engineer, civil.
All right. Mm. Okay. And so, did you just go study... I know you were in a Christian music school after school.
Yes.
So did you
Joyful
do...
Noise.
Yes, there's the name. I forgot that.
Yeah.
Did you do that directly after school? Was that kind of your tertiary education?
Well, I did a year in Jeffreys Bay at a similar sort of place.
Yeah.
With maybe more focus on a pastoral element.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know it was going to be as religiously focused when I went there.
I know one, but I know one funny story you told me way back when we kind of met is that you were living with the OBS in the Sokkies lie for a year or so.
Yeah, yeah.
Like very philosophically stated.
Yeah, that's good. I suppose with anything where you it's a bit of a, what's that guy, Wizard of Oz sort of a thing. You see behind the curtain and it's all a lot less impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I went from there, I did a little certificate course at the Stellenbosch University, which at the time was very classical focused. I think it's become more contemporary focused. But myself and Rory Skinner.
Yes.
And Matt Sivanakul.
Yes, yes. So you started
Matthew Dickinson. We were all together in one big class.
Matthew Dickinson now plays for, what's that band? He's got a new band.
Absolutely destroys that telly.
It's on the tip of my tongue.
Sounds
now.
Good. He sounds good.
Is it?
Yeah, I like his song.
You don't know the name of the band?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Suppose we can give it a Google.
So I'm going to backtrack. So school vibes, where was your musical awakening? Like your first encounter where you decided, fuck, I love what I'm hearing.
High school? My parents play, my dad plays guitar.
All right.
Sing-along stuff. My mom plays as well. My gran's very musically adept.
Mm.
So she always hammered on us, you know, learn the chords, but what are the notes in that chord? And that kind of started me on the whole asking questions about the music you're playing. And then the normal thing, tabs, whatnot. The bug really bit, I suppose, around grade 11. And I started hearing things that I really liked. And I feel like it was quite musically sheltered. I used to listen to a lot of my parents' older music.
Yeah.
Fleetwood Mac, that sort of stuff. And I just love it.
And did you ever have like a period, because a lot of people, like a lot of good musicians or good guitarists, whatever the case may be, they had like a period in school or in varsity where they had more time on their hands, where they really digged in and just like played a lot, you know, the whole time. Did you have a period like that? And if you had, when would you say was that?
Yeah, I did.
And did you mostly then play by yourself?
Yeah. From a trick and then up until Joyful Noise. And Joyful Noise was a really good part about it. We got not forced into, we got put into these preparation bands.
What is that?
You just learn a lot, very large repertoire.
All right.
And that really gets the chops up.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there with Joyful Noise, I mean, there was my second year there, we played 180 something gigs in the year.
Yes.
And that was mostly corporate on the bigger side of things. And that really, you know, you spend all this time knuckling down learning, that by the time you sit down to do some scales and do personal practice, it's the most refreshing thing for you ever. And you really dig in and you do like 2 hours of it every evening. And that's where the boost really comes in.
Shit, man. That amount of gigging just kind of explained to me something I never could really get my mind around, is where did you become that fucking chopped? Just like where... Yeah. Obviously, you've got talent. You've got inherent talent. But, I mean, you got to do something with that talent. You're still going to be a mid-range musician if you don't do something with that talent.
You've got to get out there and play. Hey?
So that's what I'm... explains a lot to me, all that gigging, because that's obviously, like you said, where the shit started setting.
Yeah, that's where it really set in. And then... But that was more, you know, just being able to play well.
Yes.
And then what I'd call the flash or the pizzazz, that developed with teaching a lot.
Mm.
I taught at Doremy and Somerset West for a long while.
And at where?
I taught there a few lessons sporadically. When I was quite a lot younger in Stratford Cash, I worked in their workshop repairing guitars and pianos and stuff. Yeah, thinking about getting back into that. It's always fun.
Yeah.
So it's lovely to get your hands on a nice instrument and just feel it.
And then what I also wanted to know, was there any... Okay, well, you said you only really got into playing and music and listening and stuff and sort of around grade 11, but did you do any band-related stuff in school?
Me and my buddy Jeron, we had a little band in high school, and I dabbled with playing jamming with buddies with metal bands, but we didn't have a band that we were booking gigs and stuff.
Yes.
And I mean, at that point in George, there'd maybe be a gig on a month if you're lucky, and it'll be the same couple of old dudes jamming covers in a pub. So there wasn't much room for that. But then I got in with like dudes from church or whatever, jamming with the old guys, particularly this one saxophonist Paul, and just playing with them. But I wasn't really gigging much then. It wasn't actively gigging.
But now, around about what time is this in Georgetown? What time did you matriculate?
2004. So this is like 2002-ish.
Around there,
And then till then, 2005, I was in Jeffreys Bay, 6 and 7 at Joyful Noise.
Yeah.
But 8 and 9 at the university.
Okay, cool.
What are we going to be off in between?
We're going to get to the university now, but I want to quickly go back to Joyful Noise.
Mm-hmm.
We touched on it, but I want to know more about like the experience being in a Christian school. Were you a strong believer then when you joined the school?
Yeah, I'd say I was, as one is when you come out of high school.
Yes.
And I think I had my eye opening later than most in that sense.
Okay.
But yeah, I was into it.
And was there actually a period in the Joyful Noise where like you say, the eye opening happened? Were you still there when that happened? And
yeah, it was at the start of Joyful Noise, where I think that started to...
And how was that vibe? Like being there, because you're there for music, but now you kind of get this vibe that, okay, secularization, maybe it's not, maybe it is, you know? So how is that vibe? Because now you're stuck between music and religion, sort of, if you know what I mean.
Like, they, to their benefit, they never... you know, try to push you in one sense, you know, if you want to make music, you make music. And the variety of people from a very big variety of walks of life that were at Joyful Noise, helped with that. Because there were, you know, people who were just there for the music.
Okay.
And people who were just there for the belief. And they wanted to be a part of it as a ministry, you know, the traveling around to schools and whatnot.
Yes.
That was their thing. So it kind of... they did that part and we did our part.
So they were a bit more liberal and relaxed about it.
Yeah, liberal and relaxed about your own beliefs, not really their core beliefs.
I get that.
I mean, there was I can remember a thing where there was a big hoo-ha and an explosion because one of the girls that had been there for a long time, she came out to everyone and they shunned her big time.
Hectic.
Yeah, and that was...
that's bad, eh?
That's a part of like, I don't really know. You mean you're telling me love and acceptance, and then someone you've been friends with and who's been in your core group for years, they finally have the courage to do this and you kick them out and ostracize them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very weird turn, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah. You're supposed to be drawing those people in and trying to change them by example.
Yes. Okay, but now moving forward to the university. So then you say by 2009, around there, you came to Stellenbosch.
9, 10, I came to Stellenbosch.
How did that happen?
Well, I was in Stellenbosch still. After Joyful Noise.
Okay.
I think I then I taught then at Botanist with Duncan Coombe.
Oh, right. Yeah, I don't know what I mean.
Yeah, really cool dude. Like he's got his head on right when it comes to, you know, getting kids in high school to actually be passionate about music.
Yeah.
You check the kids in his department, they're really fucking dig jamming, and they just jam all the time. And then I came back and did the certificate course. It's a little 2-year, I suppose it's supposed to be a bridging to a BMus, maybe.
Is that not at the university?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then in that time you started working in the studio as well.
Yeah, started rubbing shoulders with Gerard Roux.
Yeah.
He's also a bit of a genius. he's a difficult guy to be around on a personal level.
I believe so, yeah.
But amazing, yeah, and fucking nuts musician, like pianist of note. He'll just sit down and jam, you know.
Mm.
One of those people you say, play this tune, he'll... talk it out.
Yeah. And you obviously learned a lot of audio and sound from him. You got a lot of experience.
Yeah. Mm. I was there together with Gerard Groblaar at that time. Yes. Yeah, and that's how I got to know him. Well, I'd known him from Toffees and stuff.
Yes.
But I'd never, like, we never hung out sober, if you know what I mean. It's always after a couple of beers at a gig, you know, just shooting the shit, not actually sitting down and...
And being sensible.
Yeah, and having a chat, you know, when you sit around someone all day.
Yeah, he was here the other day when I had Willem in. He was accompanying Willem. So he was just sitting here quietly in the corner.
Those are two beautiful peas in a very unrounded pod.
That's a good way to put it. Right, where were we now? Audio and sound and stuff. So you said a lot of experience came from there, from Gerard and from actually... Because part of that course... is technology.
Yeah, so
it's not it's not just playing. There's a lot of audio and sound as such stuff involved.
Yeah, I'd been versed in the practical elements of live engineering.
Yes.
And I'd been doing that quite a lot. I mean, that was I worked for the company Audio Mission.
All right.
And with Joyful Noise, I was on the technical team. And when I was in Jeffrey's Bay, I just did the sound with them. Yeah, and so I'd been doing sound a lot, and growing up with my parents, you know, when they'd be doing little gigs and tours and stuff, I was the youngest of the boys, and I'd be the one, you know, helping plug in the cables.
Hands on.
Yeah, hands on. And I mean, and they used to take us everywhere with them, which is cool. Yeah, but being under Gerard was the awakening of my studio bug, I can say it. Like I'd you know, played around with trying to do some recordings with a little tape deck and overdubbing and stuff.
Yes.
Very, very frugal. And then with him it was then blam, straight into Pro Tools.
And big sessions.
And big sessions. We did some cool stuff. We did Kumba's soundtrack.
Wow.
And
choir stuff.
A lot of choir stuff. We recorded a couple of the award-winning years of the Stellenbosch Choir.
If you had to tell somebody that doesn't know a thing about it, in dry language, how do you mic up a choir? How do you actually go about doing that?
You've got to have them in the right space first.
Yes.
But if you've got them in a nice room, the most simple way is to get a XY pair, which would be...
Okay.
Pair of mics at 90 degrees.
Yes.
With the business ends facing the crowd. The choir.
Yes.
In layman's terms. And if you can afford to, a set of nice omnidirectional outriggers would be good.
So it's actually a very minimal setup.
Very minimal, very minimal. Okay. If you've got a nice room sound, a nice ambience in the room, I wouldn't see the value in recording everybody separately.
Yeah.
Because the blend is just as important as individual tones. The conductor will shush the voices and get the voices balanced.
Yes, he'll do the authentic mix.
Yeah, and I've almost found that if you close mic by section or whatever, it's often tough to satisfy the client when it comes to approval of the mix.
Okay.
Because they were standing directly under the mics.
I see.
And they heard that.
Yeah.
And now you're trying to replicate the blend between the sections.
So, and then how long did you stay at the Conserve for? Did you work there after you finished studying? Because I remember I was there in 2011, I think it was. And then you were still there.
To drum on a session.
Yeah, it was so...
Kit.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember. So when did you actually leave the studio?
I can't remember. One day I'm going to run for, like, political office and see what the press pulls out so I can put my 20s back together. But I don't remember the timeline exactly, but I was there for quite a while. And then... That didn't really pan out very well. you know, I'm not the best at hooking my own clients and everything, and it's a difficult situation where you're paying a fixed rental per day, and it's not a cheap facility.
Yeah, so you actually hiring the space and you're recording in there, yeah.
Yeah, but that was the opportunity given to me, but then on the side of that, I did a lot of editing of concerts and bouncers and mixes and stuff for Gerard. Okay. So there was a fair amount of work, and he pays quite well.
Now I want to go back to live sound, because I just have to state on the record again, I've said so on the VAT podcast, but I am a huge fan of your live mixing.
Thanks, dude. I did actually hear that, right?
So I want to know when, sort of around when did you start working at Antlers? Can you remember that? And if you can't, then you can just tell me how that happened.
I suppose I started working at Antlers in the bar first.
All right. Well, I remember that.
When Brius was still there.
Yes.
Which is probably like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yes.
I worked under Brius a bit, and then I worked in the bar, and then Brius left, and I kind of became more involved there.
Yeah.
And it was, like most things in my life, kind of just happened, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Because you were there and you... You
I was
know
there and I was available and I knew it was going on.
And you were doing that for long, right?
Antlers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been working with Marcus for, I suppose, 5 years.
Yeah.
And we're doing a lot of, not just Antlers, a bit of shameless promo, Patriot Productions that does other gigs outside.
Okay.
Yeah, we did some cool stuff. We did a nice thing with A King at the Route 44.
And then there was a period where you sort of left Stellenbosch and you went to stay in Cape Town for a while. I think if I'm not mistaken, I'm moving forward a lot, back and forward, so sorry about that. I'll come back to some other stuff. But then you were playing with Bam Bam Brown for a little while.
I went to live with the house I was staying in Stellenbosch got flattened. And I went to go stay with Kieran. Mm. Me and Bon Scott packed up, and that's my dog. Bon Scott, the one-time lead singer, the world-famous Australian rock band AC/DC. When he dies, I'm just going to replace him with a dog just like him, called him Brian.
Yeah. Okay, so you guys packed up?
And we went off and were staying with Kieran, and then I was playing with Kieran a lot.
What did you do job-wise then? Because then you were working at Antlers.
I was.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. Okay. So I was still coming back for Antlers. It was then two nights a week, Wednesdays or Tuesdays and Saturdays. Okay. So it was that, and then gigs with Bam Bam.
Yeah.
And then I was helping out at the market and whatnot.
No, because to me, it almost felt like you had a gap where I didn't see you at Antlers. And then recently, I started seeing you a lot more. Not recently, but like in the last year or two, whatever. I checked you again. So it's like, okay.
I moved back to Somerset West. Yeah, I moved. I was staying in Somerset West. And so now I'm in the main London, yeah.
Yeah, so now you can you can handle going there a lot more again than going from Cape Town.
Yeah, just popping in to quickly help set up and then leave someone to babysit it and pack away in the evenings for like a non-crucial gig or whatever.
Yeah, and then, but now, what do you job these days?
Now I'm in food safety in Gordon's Bay. Yeah.
Okay.
So complete the plaster. Dave Diedrichs, Danger Dave, drummer from Ape Generals back in the day.
Yes, yes.
What was his band with Jason September? All the Brave, We the Brave.
Yeah. Yes, David.
David, not Dave.
Yes.
Nobody knows him as Dave. Monster drummer too. Also, self-taught and just has so much fun with it.
Yeah.
He's
actually also from Worcester.
Yes. Worcester Pooster.
So food safety. Yeah. How does that actually work?
They were, so it's, you know, health and, well, the safety of the food. So checking product to make sure that there's no.
All right. Like quality control vibes.
Basically, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So you're working with him?
Yeah, he's just recently resigned. He's going overseas to go study in Hungary, actually.
Sure, that's quite a... I didn't actually expect that from somebody like him. I thought he's like set in his ways now.
He's in the family business. Yeah.
He's doing this job. You know, he's here to stay. That's actually interesting. Wow. Okay, so that's your job now. But now I'm going back to Stellenbosch, to the years of the Conserve. Somewhere around that time, or you must tell me now. Somewhere before actually going to the Conserve, you started Third World with Pieter, and were you there from the beginning?
No, well, he had Third World Spectator already.
Yeah.
There's a guitarist, Sean Kelland, with them at the moment, at that time. I don't think he's ever really played for anyone else, I think. And I think he described it at one point when we first, because Dre and I made a post, or we saw a post on Bothner's, used to have like a classifieds page on their website. And we saw a post for a band looking for a drummer and a guitarist. And at that point, the two of us had kind of, we were probably way ahead of our time, maybe, I don't know, but doing like a Hellcat sort of, we were just in our jam room, just guitar, plugged into the guitar amp and a bass amp, riffs and drums. Yeah. You know, we were just jamming for our own satisfaction. Yeah. And we thought, like, we really need to get ourselves playing with someone.
Yeah.
And we went to meet him at Julian's, when it was Julian's the first time still. Yeah, and went for a rehearsal, and there was a gig like in a week's time.
What? So you guys had to pull it?
Yeah, we just crunched it all in, and I think we played at Hidden Cellar. Yeah, it was Hidden Cellar upstairs from the Acker.
Jeez. How's that for touch and go? We've got a gig, but we don't yet have a drummer and a guitarist. Let's quickly line it up.
Yeah, and you know, okay, cool. Do you have charts? Sure, you put your finger here on 7, and then 7, like Pete's a great songwriter, but he's not a shredder, and I think that was a great part of our dynamic, in that he'd write something in his room and there's no rules for it. You can't put 3 chords like that straight after each other. And
so he's not like formally trained
vocally.
Yes, but I'm speaking about guitar.
But it's weird because when he plays, you know, it'll just be power chords of Third World.
Yeah.
But when he sits at home, he'll sit and he'll talk all some picking stuff. Yes, and that.
But more intricate stuff.
I think he identifies himself as a vocalist and a songwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, but around, what year was this now that you guys played that Hidden Cellar game? Was it like around 27, 28?
Maybe even later than that. That was still in Joyful Noise. Yeah. So second year of Joyful Noise. We can work it out. 27,
yeah.
Okay. Jeepers, 11 years ago.
Jeez, that's some time.
Crisis. Yeah, when I was looking for the photo for you,
yeah,
I was like going through this blasts from the past.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Some crazy, crazy times. Yeah.
I'm glad I sent you on a cool journey.
Yeah.
All right, so now moving forward with Third World, so did you guys started playing regularly then? What was the vibe? How did it progress? Because what I also wanted to know, what's very important for this discussion, is you guys were signed with Universal Records.
Yeah.
And I would really like to know more about that. Was that a distribution label?
It was a... We'd recorded...
Record deal.
Yeah, we'd... I need to think carefully. I think we'd recorded Theory of Everything... Or we'd recorded demos.
Yeah.
And then they funded the album and they'd funded the Ambulance's video. It was like a proper deal.
Okay, that's... Yeah, that's a bit different than only...
Than distribution, there was some tour support and they really looked after us very well.
Yeah, that's pretty serious, dude. If you can just describe, like, how did that gig happen? Did you approach them or did they saw you?
We recorded the demos ourselves.
With Jürgen?
No.
Oh, just demos.
Between myself and De Toy Skiver, who played with us at the time.
Okay.
He was at Cape Audio College and he... Not Cape Audio College, I lied to you. City Varsity.
Oh, yes.
And we went and did for our pracs. That's where we recorded The Truth there. And then it was The Truth plus a few more tunes.
Yeah.
I think there was a demo of Sparks.
Cool. Which later went on the album.
Yeah. Yes. There was a couple of tunes, a couple of demo tunes that didn't make the album. And we wrote quite a lot that were just on the album.
Was that, were you guys rehearsing at Do Re Mi that time? Or was that at a different place?
Yeah, we rehearsed at Do Re Mi at that time.
Because you had quite a nice setup there. You had upstairs. Like your own room and you could record there. You were sharing with Black Market Riots, I think?
Yeah, there was the room upstairs was shared between, I think, Mind Assault, Black Market Riots.
And you guys. Us. Yes, yes.
No. I think Helderview was in there as well because they recorded their studio, their album in that space.
Okay.
And then we came in after that and then we had it on our own. Mm. I had it as a teaching space.
Teaching space, yeah.
And I had my little recording set up there.
Yeah. Yes, that must have been some good times, Bruce.
It was great times. Yes. It was great times.
Teaching, you've got your recording set up there. You all, like, everything is boxed in one kind of area, sort of what I'm doing here with tunes, but just with a difference that I don't teach from here. I teach from Bathner, so
and
yes, that sounds like
not nearly as grand as here. it was really shoestring sort of thing, but it worked at the time.
And backtracking to the record deal, how did that happen? Like, did you send them the demos or?
Pete went and shopped it around. He's a good marketing mind and obviously he's a phenomenal designer.
Yes.
And he went and shopped it around. And there was a couple of...
So he put himself out for a record. He was actually looking for it.
Yeah, yes. He went out for it.
Okay.
And he did a very good job. Myself and him are still signed with Universal Publishing.
Oh, serious?
Yeah, I co-wrote two of the tunes with him.
Okay.
Yeah, but the rest he did all himself. I just did the music. I didn't do any of the lyrics in that. That's his department. He's got he's quite the poet.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And he shopped around. Then Benji Moody was there. I suppose what do you call it? An A&R guy or whatever at that time. And we went up on a tour. We played, I think, Tan's Cafe and Barcelona and places like that. They came to check us out. And then, it's kind of just steamrolled from there. I wasn't very involved in the...
Yes.
The whole process.
In the business side.
Yeah.
And besides the fact that you guys had some tour support and this and that, would you say that the label made the journey a lot easier? And but partly also asking... Did the record label make it possible for you guys to actually make some bucks out of the band?
We never really sold enough albums to recoup and make bucks out of that side.
Yeah, but with gigging and stuff.
With gigs, they definitely got us onto a platform where we could expose ourselves. You know, I think actually it may have had quite a lot to do with the... I've completely forgotten about it until now.
Mm.
That whole Road to V-Fest thing.
Okay.
It was like a Virgin Mobile sponsored like nationwide band battle.
Yes.
And we somehow got in. We sort of weren't on the list and then someone pulled out from one of the PE legs.
Yeah.
The PE pool, I suppose. Mm. And we went down and... It was one of those things like pedal broke and I was just, playing with a tuner pedal plugged into a Marshall, balls to the wall. I think kind of stripped down rock and roll, two guitars.
Yes.
It's kind of the best way to experience Third World. And then we went on to win the whole shebang.
Yeah.
Wow. I played it in the Coca-Cola Dome with Maroon 5 and One Republic.
Jeez.
And I think that all rolled into the
label.
Yeah, because we then had a prize money from that and we used the prize money from that to record our album.
Yeah. Because the listeners, there's probably a lot of people listening or that, I would wish a lot of people. There would probably quite a few people listening and actually not... heard Third World's music before. So I just need to say it for the record and for the listeners. You guys were a fucking hot band.
Thanks, dude.
I once saw you guys. I saw you guys quite a few times.
Plenty.
Yeah, but the one time I specifically remember was in 2012, somewhere in 2012. I saw you guys at Bohemia. And you guys just stepped in and killed that fucking shit. You guys played song after song. You went straight into the songs from the previous one. It just gelled as such a ridiculously hot gig. And I was feeling that groove, man. I'm like, yeah, this band sets. Like you,
yeah, Louis
like
and
I like to say.
Louis King, the bassist, and I used to put a lot of effort into, you know, what follows key-wise from each other. How can we key change an outro into the next song? How can we writ a song so that as it becomes comfortable to end, it is the count of the next song?
Yes.
So I'm still playing out the chords and Andre's chopping us in for the next jam.
Yes.
So yeah, it was that element of Third World was not the live shows. I've never experienced anything like it.
Obviously, I can totally check that because you had Peter, which we now know is a phenomenal talent. He actually once did a vocal workshop here at Tunes.
Yeah.
And it was one of the best attended workshops when I still did workshops here. Yeah, definitely one of the best attended, and it was a really cool Joel. I mean, he's super talented. Then you have you, great writer, great guitarist. You have Andre, great drummer. Louis is a spectacular musician as well. You guys had a few bassists and lineup changes. And then at the stage, you had a keyboardist, Milan, as well.
Yeah, Ilan.
Pieter's
cousin, yeah.
Yes.
Great dude as well. Actually, also a drummer.
All right.
And then, yeah, he played keys. Louis and I shared keyboard duties for a lot of stuff, and then there'd be some of the acoustic shows and that where I'd play some keys and Louis would play acoustic, and also radio stuff a lot. Louis is also a talented guitarist and vocalist. So yeah, it was a very nice ensemble to play, you know.
What would you say was, besides the, well, maybe we have touched that now that you've mentioned the Maroon 5 gig, but is there any other biggest moments for you with Third World? Like big achievements, big gigs?
Yo, we jammed some Ramfests.
And Kopi?
Yeah, we did. Kopi was amazing.
Yeah. Well, how was your slot there?
It was good. We were evening, around 7, 8-ish, I think, on the Brailoff.
Nice.
So, there was already a good 1,005 strong crowd when we got there.
Yeah.
You know? So, it wasn't like we had a Ramfest. We were 11 o'clock Saturday morning.
Ew, I remember that. I was there.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, I think Pete came out of the stage and he was like, wake up! Wakey, wakey, you know?
Yeah, you need to get the people there, kind of.
Yeah,
you know?
That was a really great set, because by the end of the set, everybody crawled out of their tents, and there was actually a crowd.
It was a vibe, yeah.
That dispersed for the next band, which, as bad as it sounds, kind of feels good, you know, when you jam and then...
I mean, it's like you say, it sounds bad, but it gives you a pat on the shoulder.
Yeah, you know, so that you've not...
You've done something right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so any other like big achievements, big moments? Was that my Kopi, Ramfest?
Those gigs are always shrouded in stress. Like,
yeah.
You know, like the big stuff, you kind of, and everyone's so far away and everything.
Yeah.
My favorites, our last show at On Plus was, well, not our last show.
Yeah.
The last show that was supposed to be our last show, and then
there was a sneaky one in 2015.
There was another
yeah.
But like those are always the great. There's I can remember the shows where the stage is so small. Bohemia is always great.
Yeah. Bohemia is a great place.
I think,
always have a Joel there.
I think the photo either that I sent to you or that I shared on Instagram today was also a showstopper. It was at Mercury. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was also just great times that
time. Yeah, yeah. And Tell me now, speaking third world, did your view, well, let me not say it that way. Obviously, your view of what success for a rock band in South Africa means changed from the beginning of you joining Third World and after Third World was over, or my like views to the end. Your views of what success a rock band, of what success means for a rock band in South Africa. Like, yeah. In terms of, you obviously had a vibe, like, cool, I want this and this and this. And then that obviously changed as you progressed with Third World.
Yeah, I mean, obviously when you're young and you think of it and you're like, oh yeah, you know, want to be on top of the world, big house, five cars, don't trust nobody. I do love my hippity hop. And then as you get into it, you realize that, you know, success is just being able to get paid $5,000 for a gig when yep. you ask for it.
Yep.
You know, that's... success isn't playing Ramfest once a year at 11 o'clock at night.
Yes. So yeah. The roof is... You realize that the roof is a bit lower than you thought. And what you also realize is that you shouldn't chase this dragon, like just move towards this kind of, we're going to make it, this is going to be the big moment. You should be in the moment and take that where you are at the moment. You must experience that as, this could be the pinnacle. You know,
yes, yes. Like I've often, now that you say it, I mean, one often thinks back and goes, you know, that was, I mean, who knows what will happen in the future.
Yeah.
But I would definitely, if I was to start something and it would start being that successful again, I would definitely view it different. Mm. I think, you know, having the feeling that you're chasing something does help with an ethic.
Yes.
But also there's a sense of euphoria that you don't really stop to smell the roses. You're too concerned with climbing the ladder.
Yes.
To turn around and look at the view.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. That's a very, very good analogy. So then moving on, obviously this is a tricky one to answer, and you can obviously just say what you want, but how did the band end? How did that happen?
You know, there were obviously all our differences and stuff, but that didn't really, you know, Louis moved to Pretoria, Pete moved to Pretoria.
All right.
And that was
basically it.
Yeah. And now, I mean, I think I'm the only one left in the Cape.
Where's Andre?
Andre's in China.
What?
Yeah, teaching English.
That's why you're not here.
Louis in Pretoria, I believe, working. Pete's in New York.
Yes, I checked that actually on Facebook.
I'm not actually sure where Lani is. I think he's still around here in Somerset West. Mm. I heard Hiku said he bumped into him the other day.
Yeah, sorry, you still wanted to say?
I was going to say the other day, but it could have been months ago, really.
And then, also now, finishing off with Third World, I kind of know this feeling, but I think for you, it was a bit more acute. How do you deal with being in a successful band like Third World Spectator, and then that's now... It's to an end. So
and
now
then you, just not.
So yeah, and now you don't have that vibe of fuck, we're killing it. The band is cooking. You know, you don't have that vibe. You don't have the nice gigs. You don't have the just being in a working band. You know, a band that
I mean, not that it wasn't paying bills.
Yeah, no,
it was definitely helping.
Yeah,
yeah, it is. I mean, it's like a breakup. You know.
Yeah.
And you come home and you sit down to practice and you're like,
what am I practicing for?
Guess I better learn some cream. you're not rehearsing for a gig and you miss the date nights.
Yeah.
The rehearsal.
Yes.
The rehearsals and the going for beers and the band chats and that. It's like a breakup.
Yeah. A band is very much like a romantic relationship like that. It can cause very deep sorrow if something that you truly love and it's like a child you're nurturing, you've grown up with this thing, like you've seen it become You've seen it climbing the ladder, you know.
Yeah.
So what did you musically do after Third World then? What direction did your music taste then?
Well, when Third World was winding down, I was already then playing with Hechu.
Okay. Like the Sunday Vibes in Bohemia.
Yeah. And that is, playing with Hechu is definitely one of the most musically satisfying things. So you're playing
for
with
sure.
something that's playing, being able to play whatever you want over somebody that is that.
That knows his shit.
Yeah, and just knows his shit. That,
yeah.
And that rhythmically solid.
Yes.
You know, you can try some 7/6 lines if you want to.
Yes.
And it's not going to flip him.
Yes.
At all,
mm-hmm.
you know. And just, you don't, you know that, you know, with Hechu stuff, and even with Nick, I mean, I very seldom play any chords.
Yeah.
And I think Third World's the last time I was chugging out chords.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, it's been a completely different journey, that, but I mean, it's...
You must have played some chord-based stuff in Bam Bam.
Oh, yeah, definitely,
yeah.
definitely. Playing with him's a hoot.
Yeah.
I played with Bam Bam and the Wild Professors for a short while.
Mm.
But other than that, I was just doing the Sunday thing with them. It was easy. We lived together. We get in the car. We go play in Kormaki, come home and have a bride.
I had a little jam with Bam Bam, with Kieran at Strab. We were having a huge camp
jam.
And he pulled in. We had a fuck big camp jam. There was just people pulling in all over. Riku was in the front, just getting everybody in. Like, hey, bro, I want to play your tune work. And then it just became this big center of attention thing. And Norza was joining us, and she was singing the most beautiful stuff. And the photographer Henry, I forgot his surname now, but the photographer, he came in and started filming the stuff. Anyway. Just jamming with Kieran, it was my first time. I was just jamming on a cooler box. I made like a cooler box was my cajon. And I just felt two things.
Kulechon was
a kulechon.
There's a pun in there. I love you. Love
yeah.
a pun. What's it called when you put two words together?
It's like a, isn't it an acronym?
I don't know.
But anyway, two things I took home from Kieran is dynamics. He's great with that. And rhythm. Jeez,
yeah.
It's great. Like, I just felt that solid rhythm. Like, I felt safe playing around him, you know?
Yeah, he really gets... And he does some tempo changes and stuff, and even with that, he leads well.
Yeah,
And I think with playing with lots of different people over the years, you very much... I suppose it's like dating. You figure out what you like and what you want.
It's a dance, yeah.
Yeah, and then you know I very much respond to the rhythmically solid people. I know that's a shortcoming in my own musical toolkit. But playing with something that's that rhythmically solid.
You say rhythmically solidness is a shortcoming in your toolkit. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I won't say that, but okay.
Well, if I were to pick a weak spot, that would be it, yeah.
I see.
But
yeah, it doesn't come across that way. But yeah, sorry, you were moving somewhere?
I don't recall.
Okay, but now, okay. Any other bands besides Nick Maruki, Hechu, Bam Bam, Third World? Any other gigging stuff that you've done?
I jam with old Picky, with Light and Shade.
Yeah, we actually jammed together at that one Hunklip gig. You remember last year?
Oh, yeah, that was a riot,
hey? Yeah, that was a total riot.
That was about this time of year, wasn't it?
Yes.
A little bit later than this.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Nah, yeah, it was great.
Any future music plans?
Well, I'm playing with Jumping Guns now. I've
completely
left that out, yeah.
What?
Since Andrew left, yeah, I replaced Andrew. And I think it's been about a year and a half now. A year and a half that I've been with them. We're not gigging a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is totally news to me.
Yeah.
So who's in Jumping Guns all now? Is Alex? Alex is obviously still there.
Myself, Alex the sound guy. Alex, myself, Jan Hendrik, still Johannes on the drums, and Stefan on the keys.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what sort of gigs do you guys play? Because I don't see any events of not, no. Sorry to say, but...
No, it's not. I mean, we haven't played in months, eh? Yeah. I think the last time we played was at Aunt Class.
Okay.
Yeah. I think everyone's just in on their work.
But you're doing jamming, you're doing rehearsals.
No, we're not.
Not really, okay.
Not really. I did a guest, it was a guest spot, the cameo,
yeah.
On their EP.
Yeah.
I did a solo at the end of one of the tracks.
Yeah.
And then from there, kind of just, I don't know if I was a natural choice for them, but I think my...
Organically.
Yeah, it just happened,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Do you recall, sorry, I'm jumping off the track here, but I just reminded myself that I need to ask this. Do you recall the first time we met? Can you recall that? It's a bit of a blur, eh?
No. I can tell you now, Teche was involved.
Okay.
Antipathy
Teche.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember checking him. I did sound at a Metal for Africa gig, and there was something wrong. I think someone had trapped something out or whatever. He just jumped on the stage and had a boobie competition in the middle of a band.
I remember that gig.
Yeah,
wow.
I can remember from that evening is that contrast. The water was just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I think Springbok, Pub, Antipathy played. That's where it would have been 2006.
Yeah.
But I don't think we really became tight and conversational. And then I didn't see you. You know, then I don't think we were...
Because I recall literally kind of meeting you around the first time you guys jammed at Tunes. And then I kind of got the vibe that we have met before, but
yes,
it just didn't click to me.
And it took us a couple of meetings to kind of like...
To figure that out.
Put this together. Because even...
Even from Wooster.
From Wooster.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a joke I made. No, that was actually one of his jokes. Anyway, he was at Joy for Noise as well.
Yes. He's playing with Andras Silje now. Well,
really?
Well, he's
been playing with Andras for ages.
Yeah, it's not... No. Recently, it's actually changed because he moved down to the Western Cape again. But
no,
he's still like...
him and Gion making videos.
Yes. What the hell is up with that videos? And I've heard it's the most ridiculous things ever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I checked him in Strab. He played for Andras Strab. So
she's playing with the full band?
Yes.
That's slick. How's it sound?
It's sounding great. I unfortunately just finished over an hour set, so I ran for the food after that. So I missed this set. But
not a big eater preset.
No.
I don't like to gig with a full tummy.
Yeah, and also the gig was at 5 in the afternoon, so it's a bit early to eat.
This is a man's dinner. At our age, one has to stick to dinner time.
Yeah, so where was this?
Meeting each other.
Yes. So that was like kind of Springbok vibes and then Tunes. But now the same breath, I want to ask, do you have any first impressions of checking this little Tunes place? Because it was a super tiny space when you first got there. We're still there across the road.
Yeah, it was across the road.
Yes.
It was hectic. It was interesting, you know. Stellenbosch didn't have anything like that.
Yeah.
We were having to drive out to Durbanville or to...
Somerset,
which, I mean, the only thing that separated Doremi's rehearsal space from yours was that yours was enclosed with some cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't much special about that.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. I liked it. You know, rustic. Still rustic. But rustic.
It's still
good.
Rustic, yeah. But back then it was like a passage. It wasn't it's a little hangiki, literally.
You had amps stored in the little kitchenette and stuff.
That was very tucked in, like very, very actually compact in a way, but uncomfortably compact. But
yeah.
But that was the beginning of it, and I mean you must have that times. But yeah, man,
I'm a big believer in never despise the days of a humble beginning.
Yes. No, that's... one can take home. I want to backtrack to sound stuff and kind of finishing off, sort of. Like I've said now, I'm on stage and in front of the stage. I like what you're doing behind the mix. Now, a difficult thing is to get the on stage sound right. How do you have anything to share with regards to that? Because nowadays the Oaks got like technology that helps them to actually mix from the stage. But yeah. If you don't have that, how do you actually go about?
I think, and I believe this would hold true for Alex as well, a big perk is being a player who plays on stages.
Yes. Yes.
I think a big part of our on-class stage sound and where it is now from where it was 4 or 5 years ago, not a lot has changed. I mean,
that stage.
Yeah, we know it. And we've played on it. I mean, I've played a gig standing in front of every monitor except the drums.
So
I think, but you know, any venue, if I go to Mercury, while the band's playing, I go walk around on the stage and just go hear it and just go hear how the sound changes and how it walks around, how it moves around, you know, how the big thing is watching how people are reacting. If you see the drummer is straining, looking at the guitarist all the time, chances are he's going to ask you for more guitar. So put it up, you know.
Jeez, man, there's
an intuition that comes with it.
Yes.
But I think also, I mean, part of you being so satisfied with the monitor mix is, I like to establish a rapport with you.
Yes.
You know? And
this is what you like,
that you can be comfortable asking me for anything.
Yeah.
But EQ plays into it a lot, and critical analysis,
and also knowing some of the musicians you work with.
Yeah.
But you're making a shitload of interesting points here, and it's actually not rocket science. But what I'm getting to is a lot I don't want this to sound like an insult, but there is a common thread that the stuff you just said, intuition, looking at the crowd, looking at the players, you know, the chances are they're going to ask you for more guitar. A lot of guys don't get that.
They have the mentality of, stuff you, I'm doing the mix.
Yes. Yes.
If you don't like it, you know, screw you.
Yes.
And first song of a set, I like to, you know, take the earplugs out, go stand in the front row.
Yeah.
Go hear what it's like in the crowd. What does it sound like in the bathroom? You know?
Yeah.
Because if it's sounding cuck at one of those places, chances are there's some way you can tweak it to find the middle ground.
Yes. I mean,
there's always a middle ground.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, it's just interesting for me because I think part of what I really like having you behind the desk is I sort of know you respect me as a musician.
Very much so.
And I think...
And a person.
Thanks, man. And I think that plays a huge part in me feeling comfortable on stage whenever you are mixing, because I know who I'm dealing with and what I'm dealing with. I remember once, it was pretty funny actually, a bit of a weird twist on what I said, is once we had a gig there with Shotgun Wedding, me and old Mark's band.
Yeah, Marky Mark.
Yeah. And,
I love Marky Mark. You're such a cool dude.
And you were doing sound check, and I think you might have maybe had a bit of a bender the previous night, whatever. And maybe you can tell me the story, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there was like rugby coming on or something, but you just pulled the plug on our sound check. I was like,
probably rugby.
I was like, fuck, man, I still wanted to check this and this and this, but you know, obviously not holding it against you. It could have been anything, but I was just like, geez, man. You don't remember that?
I don't recall.
That's good. But it's lekker to check your perspectives on sound and stuff, because you see it as not only a science, but you see it as sort of a partly a philosophy as well.
Yeah,
that's what I really like to pick your brain about. And I'm glad
you chose that, not an art form. You know,
because
it's all about your approach to the whole thing.
Yeah,
I mean, the sound coming out of the speakers, I mean, you'd know that that's only a part of the performance.
Yeah.
Everything can be pristine, but if the band's giving a lackluster performance,
yeah,
because they feel uncomfortable on the stage, then it's not going to be a good show.
Yeah.
But the sound could suffer a little bit, you know, the vocals could have to fight in the front of house so that the band can be a little bit more comfortable with their guitars on stage.
Yeah.
And that's a trade-off you have to make. You have to think about, you know.
Yeah.
Is it critical that I now say no to the vocalist?
Yes.
So you cannot have more? And then how do you approach that? Do you go with the attitude of, no, shut up, you're wrong? Or and do you go with the attitude of, hey guys, we're struggling to get the vocal out. Do you mind if we tone down these two monitors and give him some from the side?
Yeah.
You know?
And calculate the repercussions, you know?
Like, yeah.
What's going to happen if I do this?
Mm.
Okay, now just touching on biggest, not biggest, but like your nicest gigs as a live sound engineer. I know there's been many and it's really difficult to say, but like some of the coolest stories you...
Yo, I always love doing Retro Dizzy.
Oh, nice.
Them at the Incubus show, really yes, enjoyed that.
Yes, how was that, man?
Oh, it was great. It was my first time on Midas Pro 3. I learned the desk in about an hour of reading beforehand, and I got there and it's got big old buttons with lights and stuff, yes. And it's really hard to stuff up.
Was that like a kind of a first for you in terms of
big mixes?
Yeah.
No, I've done a couple of big mixes.
Like festivals and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Before bands, not running a stage.
Yes.
Yeah. And
how did that, sorry to interrupt, how did that Incubus gig happen? How did you get that?
I've been mixing Retro Dizzy for a while.
Oh, so they choose you.
They asked me to just mix them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And who did Bryn and Southern Wild?
The in-house guy, the guy who was there. Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't know that it's actually, as an opening band, you can actually go and say, like, cool, I want to bring in my sound engineer. That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
And worst experiences, worst gigs, shit just went wrong.
Sure, there's been a couple, hey? There's been a couple of hell raisers at Mystics.
Because the thing
is... Gear there is not great.
The thing is with live sound... once shit goes wrong, it goes terribly wrong. And what people don't often, musicians struggle to understand this. They're like, geez, the sound guy fucked up my sound so badly. And some cases, like we've established now, it is actually just the sound guy not paying attention. But sometimes you just cannot get out of that rabbit hole. Is it like that? Have you experienced?
Well, one of my all-time personal worst was mixing at rabbit hole. but yeah, it does tend to spiral because you start to spin.
Yes. And there's a lot going on. There's a lot to fuck up. Especially
if you've had a big delay early on in the day. Like you've had, you know, some sort of speaker thing and you're waiting for equipment. Now the band's set up and they want to go.
Yes.
And you've barely gotten through a line check and you're climbing over stuff and you're sweating and you're starting to shake a bit.
Yeah.
And that's when you make mistakes. You've got to change out a cable and you change out the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden the guitar that was working is unplugged, and the guitar that is not working is now plugged in. Now neither of them are working.
And then sometimes gear also gives you like reoccurring ghost issues, like a channel would work and then 5 minutes later that channel is dead for some reason.
Yeah.
It's like...
We for a while at Arnclass we had a little thing where there was some phantom power shorting.
Yeah.
Where the whole PA would just go goop.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'd
I've heard that. Yeah.
And it took us, I'd say, the better part of 6 months to find the gremlin, you know?
What?
And then that thing starts happening and it'll just be, you know, it'll be one guy start on the stage who starts chirping you, that negative Nancy. And then everything kind of falls apart from there.
It's such a delicate process, actually, if you think about it.
Yes. I think being on both sides of the board helps.
Yes.
With being on both sides of the board.
Yes.
Because I know you can see when the guy's having a bit of trouble.
Yes.
You know, he's struggling to find something, and there's a way to ask him a question. You know, him or if her. Ask the engineer a question. Go.
Yes.
Would you mind?
Yeah.
Would it be possible if? Instead of going, hey, asshole,
yeah.
I want this and I want it now.
It's like a power trip thing.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a power trip thing, I think. Oh. Is there anything you feel we didn't touch?
You asked earlier about highlight shows, and it skipped my mind then. I thought about it later. I don't know if when it was exactly, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It was just before Paul Wilson passed.
Yes.
His last week before he passed, it was their
10-year
reunion, Sunship Screen's 10-year reunion set.
Uh-huh.
And they asked a bunch of us to jam a tune or two with them that, you know, we knew.
Yeah.
One of my best engineering experiences ever is touring with Sudden Gypsy Queen.
All right.
You know, I did, you know, 3 or 4 shows for them. They just, I love G Willy. I played Stop Running Away with them at Orpi Corpi. That was nuts.
Nice. Yeah. So you actually joined on guitar?
Yeah, just for the one tune.
Like it.
Yeah, and Dave Van Vieren
from
Southern Wild did the vocals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that like around 2012?
He was still with Free the Animals then. Free the Animals.
He told me about that when I had Southern Wild in. I never knew
about
that.
You had them all in for a podcast.
I had the whole band.
Yeah, I was going to listen to that one.
Yeah, you should. You'll enjoy it. It happened at Up the Creek. So it was kind of a rock and roll one.
Yeah.
Folks were drinking beer.
Wait. Is that when your recorder got... So
yes.
You did with the phone.
Yes.
Yeah, I did listen to it.
Oh, cool,
actually.
Yeah. I used old Wes's phone, and it actually worked quite nice.
He's a cool dude, hey?
Old Wes, yeah. He's my bra. So, that gig, but you finished telling that story, so just wanted to touch on that. I was like,
that's something I missed, yeah.
Okay, cool. But, Justin, this was...
Absolute pleasure.
Awesome, dude.
This is great.
We had a lot of anecdotes, a lot of puns, and I think we learned that you are a pretty chirpy, light-hearted person, I would say.
I am. I don't think there's any harm in having a little humor in any situation. And turning up the kindness. Really.
Say the sound guy.
Yeah, just be nice.
Yeah.
You know, if you do nothing else, you know.
Just be nice.
Don't even tune the guitar. Just be nice.
Thanks, bro.
Was a pleasure, bud.
Hierdie was nou 'n lekker interview gewees met 'n bra wat regwaar laid back is oor staf en net uitgechill is. Hy push nie enige agendas en sulke tipe staf nie. Hy is net eerlik en hy praat pront uit oor dinge in die Suid-Afrikaanse musiekindustrie. En ons het geleer dat hy se ou met klomp anekdotes en kwinksla en net funny sayings. Hy is net oor die algemene, regtig chirpy persoon wat light-hearted met die lewe omgaan. Weer eens, dankie vir julle en gaan julle goed, lekker week. I can hear the pen drop to the